Welcome to the ColbyCast, episode 205. Thank you for joining us. Today, Bonnie and I are joined by Kaiser Johnson, an actor, writer, homeschool alumnus, husband, and father. Kaiser sits down to talk with us regarding the love story of creation. From his deepening of his faith as an adult, to his becoming an actor, to the present, we see a recurring theme of focusing on the work set before us and approaching this with joy. We hope that you'll enjoy the show.
Hi there, I'm Bonnie, Colby homeschooling mom of four lads and lasses, liturgical musician, popcorn, and podcast fanatic.
And this is Stephen, homeschooling father of five and chief homeschooling officer for Colby Academy.
Stephen, how are you?
Doing well. As we're recording here, just in Holy Week, getting ready for Easter. So, good one.
It's a good week. Yep. To set the scene for our conversation today, I'm going to take you back to the pre-COVID years. On this particular occasion, I queued up an episode of the Catholic Momcast with Lisa Hendy. I came to learn about this series of videos on YouTube called Catholic Central. So I started watching these videos and found them to be just fantastic to go along to supplement the lessons we were working through in our religion studies, our Colby homeschool religion studies, late elementary through middle school. So we would do the faith and life text and the accompanying materials and discussions. And then I would find a video from Catholic Central to go with the lessons we were working on. From there, I began to learn more and more about the folks who were working on the show. And one of them is with us today. I'm very excited to introduce Kaiser Johnson. Hi, Kaiser. Welcome to the ColbyCast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I'm really, really excited to meet you and get to visit with you. I'll try to rein it in so it's not too obnoxious. But would you tell us a bit about yourself and your background and interests? And from there, maybe a little bit about the Catholic Central era of your existence.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it all started the day I was born. No, it didn't. obviously started before then too. But no. So I am a dad and an actor and a husband. And I grew up homeschooled, which is a big part of who I am. And I came back to the Catholic Church in college and started to jump right into it. That was one of the things that drew me to Catholic Central as a project in general was, you know, I remember when I was in college, seeing so many people, you know, who were nominally Catholic and that kind of thing, leaving the faith, or and at the same time, I was asking myself all these questions about, you know, God and life and relationships and love and that kind of thing, and having this first kind of opportunity fully away from the context of my family with which to ask these questions and deal with them. And I think that's what a lot of people are doing in college and why you see so many people, people making different choices than their parents did or than their parents wanted for them. And for some that's, you know, partying, and for some that's, you know, leaving the faith and doing stuff like that. And it's less because of any actual problems with those things, but just that they go, oh, well now I get to make my own life and I'm going to decide what that's going to be. And the first thing I can think of is just to do the opposite of what my life has been so far, you know? That was certainly an opportunity and temptation that provided itself, to me, but that, luckily I was raised not that Catholic. And so then when I was asking, you know, a lot of these questions and stuff, and I ran into some Catholics who they had really good answers for all the big questions I was asking that I thought were like, oh, here are these big unanswerable questions, like that, you know, no one's going to have a good answer for, like, you know, why is God against, you know, stuff you do in the bedroom if life's so important and stuff like that. And Catholics said, well, actually, here's the good news about all that kind of stuff. And I was going, oh my gosh, this is one, you know, stuff presented in a way that I've never heard before, and two, in a way that really makes sense, and three, I was really, really kind of captivated by the beauty and the holistic nature of Catholicism. And I, you know, I don't mean holistic in a, you know, pejorative, you know, new agey sense, but in the sense of like everything, it makes sense of the universe, not just of aspects of the universe, that everything works together because it was created by the creator, and it's just the way that the world is and works. And so maybe I'm speaking in way too general terms there. And so to that captivated me, and I found out this, and it was astonishing to me, the beauty of the theology that I was not familiar with, and God's love for us, and how he creates us out of love and for love, and to love one another, and to love him, and to love each other in the process of loving him. I was swept away by this greatest love story of all time, that is God coming down and seeking out his people. And I was like, gosh, why isn't everyone Catholic? And I think an easy kind of answer to that is because our PR is real bad. You know, we don't do necessarily as Catholics a great job, and a lot of people are doing such great work in working towards this. But for a long time, you know, we've run into this issue of Catholics being, and understandably so, but poor advertisements for Catholicism, and also not having answers when the greatest answer that, you know, that the Word incarnate provides himself to us, and that it's a tragedy that we aren't able to answer those questions, those things that I thought were, oh, these are the unanswerable questions and stuff that in college. And so that's something that drew me to Catholic Central, was it was, you know, asking really relatable questions that people in middle school, high school, and college are asking, and being able to answer those with the beauty of Catholicism and the beauty of the incarnation. So there you go.
I think I was seeing on your bio on one of the pages that you were up in Duluth studying at one point. Was that?
That's right. Yeah, I did my undergraduate at, not that I did my graduate anywhere. I do not have a graduate degree. So I did my undergraduate at University of Minnesota, Duluth. So yes.
It made me think of a person I lean on heavily, Father Mike up there. Sure. At the university. So, and even like what you were talking about there, just the, I think people are, we're so much better today at this sort of communication. I mean, through things like you were doing with your presentations about the Catholics, but like Father Mike and all these people, about talking beyond just all of the doctrine and things even. I mean, so people didn't even know that particularly well when I was young, but even the fact of this personal God, this God of love that wants that for us, wants to enter in a relationship, is something that I just didn't hear much about until relatively recently. You
know, yeah.
It's odd.
It is. It's kind of astonishing. And I think that it's so unfortunate when we look at the God who loves us so much. This is something that blows my mind. It's like this idea of, we don't have a need to exist as human beings, but God, out of love for us, creates us. Like, you go, wait, how does that even make sense? But that God, out of this just gratuitous love, creates us in the first place, and creates us, and you know, you can get a little bit, as you become a parent and stuff, you can get sort of a cognate of that, of what it means to love another so much that you feel the need to bring more life into the world, and to be so, to have a way of being gratuitous with your love that goes, I want more objects for my affection, and that I have this love to give, and I want to give it more. But it's this crazy thing, and that I think so much of the experience that, and maybe I'm sure this is true in other places too, but I think just that American Catholics in general have this experience of is not being presented with that, but being presented with, you know, God wants you to follow these rules or, you know, go to hell. And it's like, well, that's coming at the understanding of it from the completely backwards side of it, you know? And you know, then as you become a parent too, you that's, I've learned so much after becoming a dad. It's like, oh my gosh, I understand so much more. My relationship with God, God's relationship with me, and what a bad job I do in my relationship with God, and also what a bad job I do as a dad, and how I, both of those, I go, I want to love more like God loves me, and that I think that's not, again, not an experience that are not something that a lot of us would initially verbalize or come away with, is I want to love more like God loves me, because we don't necessarily have an experience of or an understanding of God loving us first, and his judgment and his and the ethos, the rules that he puts in place, all as means of his love, which is it changes this whole thing. You know, when I, like, I see my, you know, 5-year-old daughter doing something dangerous, and like, I go, stop that right now. And oh my gosh, you've got to listen to me because this, and it's like, I don't want to, you know, raise my voice, or I don't want to, you know, and do that. And it's like, but I need to stop what's happening right now. And to go, oh my gosh, is that, you know, if I feel rebuked by God sometimes in my life, where I go, why would you, you know, why are you doing this? And if I can take that 10,000 foot view and go, this is God out of love reaching out to me and going, don't hurt yourself. I love you too much to let you hurt yourself here. Stop. So even these places where we see the, you know, I forget what saint it was who said it. It's probably more than one, but just that the light of heaven and the fires of hell are both the inescapable love of God. And that we get to choose how we experience that for all eternity, if we choose to let ourselves be loved by God. So,
yeah, that idea of if I didn't care, it wouldn't matter to me. I wouldn't do anything if I didn't care enough. Yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I remember something from one of the books of Maccabees, and here I'm showing my lack of specific scripture knowledge, but where they talk about God loves us so much that he punishes us immediately for our faults, rather than allowing us to, like the other nations, I guess at that point, allowing them to fall into further and further sin and further away from him. But he calls us back as soon as he can.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's an interesting idea. The idea of love having, I don't know if parameters is the right word, but it is not just whatever you want to do. I love equals you do whatever you want and it's fine.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That love, if you really love me, you would enable my destructive behavior.
Exactly. That's well said.
So, no, quite the opposite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just, I, something that in, certainly this, this Lent and, you know, I've been doing, renewing the consecration to Mary here. And I don't even remember if it's more some of the mass readings that we've been hearing or some of the readings for the consecration and stuff that I just keep running into more and more of this sense of going, okay, I want to be a better child in front of God, you know, and I want to be a better, you know, I want to be more obedient and out of, and responding out of love. And I actually just today I was while I was putting my 1.5-year-old to down for her nap and stuff, I was squeezing in a quick rosary because it takes 15 minutes to get her to bed, and meditating on the agony in the garden, and just this thought of, like, again, of this love of God. You know, there's that small T tradition that part of the agony is Christ, you know, experiencing the sins of all mankind, and you know, again, I don't know where this small T tradition comes from, but this idea that all the sins of history are present to him in that moment, and that he's going, yes, for that sin, I will offer my life down. Yes, for that sin, I will offer my life. And just thinking, oh gosh, I want to stop adding more sins for him to suffer for in the garden. Because, you know, this is our God who exists, who transcends time and space, enters into time and space. And so that it is true that my sins at this moment, if I make the choice not to sin right now, if I make the choice towards virtue right now, that affects the suffering of his passion, because that's something, an event that happened in time to a God who transcends time. And so that there's this way that I can make that a little bit easier for Christ in that moment. And that was just this, like, I was like, oh, hang on, I gotta set my baby down here for a second, because what? This is virtue and sin time travel happening. This is wild. So, but like, I have the opportunity to either contribute to Christ's agony in a negative way, or to be one who reduces that burden for him. And like, that's a wild thing to think about in Holy Week. So
makes it kind of draws things into real sharp relief.
Yeah. So I don't know if this was the light breezy kind of conversation you were at.
No, I was looking forward to this. I've heard you on a few other recordings, and I've been looking forward to like speaking to that. I'm curious about either side of the Catholic Central, like your homeschool years, whatever you want to share with us from those years, what you liked about it, what you would say to homeschooling families, anything along those lines. What do you think there?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, absolutely, yes, homeschool is awesome. And I am so glad to have, that is a huge gift that my parents gave to me, throughout my whole life. I mean, I did the year of eighth grade, not homeschooled, and half of first grade not homeschooled, but the rest was homeschool. And this just remarkable gift of one, my mom's time, that I didn't, you know, necessarily realize just what a gift that is. But now, again, now that I'm a dad, realizing like what an intensive focus it is, even just in putting together, you know, we didn't have like the idea of curricula. That was not a big thing at the time. And so, you know, it was really largely basically my mom putting things together for us and going, okay, we're going to get your math from here, and we're going to get, you know, this from here, and here are books for you to read that, you know, will help contribute to your ability to read and to write and to, you know, do all that kind of stuff. And her really putting that together. And also in the process, us really learning the skills of self-sufficiency to some extent, of learning how to learn and how to critically think and how to reason to, you know, and going from a place of, okay, I don't understand this material, or I don't understand how to do this. And then the question that I think by and large as a society we've lost is, how can I understand this, rather than just like, give me the knowledge, you know, let me. And so this, you know, my dad, when he was teaching us both math, and he would help us with math and science like once a week, and also, you know, eventually helped us with test prep and that kind of thing. And he said, you know, the thing that you look at is in critical thinking is, what do I know, and how can that help me understand what I'm being asked? And this idea of like, that's kind of central to reasoning is, you know, what do I know, and then how can I use that to understand better what I'm being asked. And that's something that applies way beyond getting ready for the PSAT. And you know, I was shocked when I got to college, and like there were people who like there was a every it was a required course that everyone had to take, Intro to College Learning, which is here's how to take a class. And it's like, shouldn't you figure that out in the last 12 years? Is, you know, how to learn? Apparently not, you know, and through some good negotiation and demonstration, I got out of taking that class because we were able to demonstrate that I did not need it because I already had learned in homeschool how to learn. And I was astonished that so many people that I knew had never, they had no idea how to do laundry, how to cook, how to clean, because they had always had someone to do that for them, and they didn't know how to learn it either. It didn't make sense, you know. And this is again, but like I was started college before YouTube was a thing, and so nowadays people probably just go how to do laundry and put that into YouTube, but back then it was like they're like I don't know, well, how would you even start? Like, well, yeah. Start by, I don't know, looking at what you know and then looking at the machine in front of you and putting it together, you know, figuring it out. I would say that ability to learn and to approach unfamiliar situations and not be thrown by them is a huge gift that homeschool and you know, my mom and my dad have given me. So. And if that's the only thing that I got out of 12 years of schooling, that would be enough. But it's a lot more. So,
sure. So you're an author, you're an actor, voiceover actor, all those things. Tell us about all that.
Sure. Yeah. So I went to college for acting. I got a Bachelor of Fine Arts in acting at Duluth. Then I moved to Los Angeles because since I was in about seventh grade and I went to a professional theater show in Minneapolis where I grew up. And I, you know, there was a Q&A afterwards. And one of the actors said, kind of in passing, they said, you know, oh, well, we're actors, so this is our job. And I was like, hold on, stop, pause. This is the job. You can do this is what you can do for a living. Sign me up. And so from that moment on, I was like, that's what I want to do. So from seventh grade on, I was like, acting. That's the thing. And I wanted to do TV and film. And so I moved to Los Angeles and have been doing what actors do, which is a lot of in between. Because you know, even very 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 successful actors spend most of their year unemployed, and it is thoroughly a gig job unless you are on a series regular on a show, and even then you're spending the whole hiatus unemployed and that kind of thing. But so doing a fair amount of acting and lots of voiceover and that kind of thing, but also doing other stuff in the in between times. It's an interesting thing to have a career, a job, and a vocation all at once, and tried to figure out how to have them all serve in you know, ascending importance. What vocation first, career second, job third, and how to make that all work.
So you've talked about the acting and a voiceover, and also your writing. So I mentioned the book that I had noticed you had published. You have since published another one. So how did that all come to be, your writing?
Oh, yeah. So actually that came about through kind of tangentially through Catholic Central. So we went to one of the first years that Libby and I through Catholic Central went to the Anaheim. There's the Religious Education Congress every year. And it's a huge gathering of Catholics and especially people involved in teaching in Catholicism. And so really cool event. And Libby and I met some folks from Our Sunday Visitor at there. And Jamie Wolf, who was there at the time, she's now at Ave Maria Press. But you know, she said, I liked the show, and have you ever thought about writing a book? And like, if you did, what would you write about? But just you and Libby seem to, and because Libby and I also worked on some of the writing of it and of Catholic Central. And she said, you know, you guys you've got an interesting voice and an interesting perspective, and you've got this audience who are interested in hearing what you've got to say. Well, would you write a book? And I said, I haven't really thought about it before, but if I did, I'd be interested to write. Basically, kind of without realizing it, pitched Grit and Glory, which is a book about faith and fitness. And also in that moment, also talked about, you know, my ideas for a book about all the mistakes I have made in my life and how I've listened to all the bad advice I've listened to, which that would, you know, become my second book called How to Be Miserable and Alone. So she was like, I'm really interested in the faith and fitness one. Let's talk about that. And so we did it. And she gave me this kind of template tool that our Sunday Visitor used to have authors pitch them ideas for nonfiction books. And so I filled out the template of, gosh, here's what this book would look like. And they said, yeah, okay, we like that. We'll publish that. And so then I had to write the book. And so, so I did. And it was kind of a cool opportunity for me too, to really delve into this deeper understanding of who I was as a person and who we all are in this human nature that we've been given. And what I've been struck by both in writing that book and in writing How to Be Miserable and Alone is how even in, like, so often I go, gosh, we should know better, you know.
Yeah.
And I guess it, like, practicing Catholics, you know, I think it's still very easy for us to fall into some wrong notions. I mean, to use the proper word, heresies, that we, you know, we have this idea of these confused notions about when it comes to, you know, faith and fitness. I look at it and go, we've drawn this artificial separation between body and soul, even in our Catholic culture, of this idea that there's this this supremacy to the spiritual that does not affect the body, or vice versa. And it's like, it's not even actually theologically proper to talk about body and soul as though they were distinct entities. You know, Peter Kraft says, he talks about, you know, as we are in incarnate souls. And he says, you know, that's why both ghosts and zombies are so disturbing to us, is because one is a soul without a body, and one is a body without a soul. And that, and why death is so, you know, in the Gospels, where it says, you know, Christ snorted in spirit, is the literal translation of when it says Jesus was greatly perturbed when he sees Lazarus in the, you know, Lazarus in the tomb. And saints have said it's because how wrong death is. Like, death is wrong. It's not, it is a material evil. It's not supposed to be there, because it separates something that's never, that it should always be one. It takes a person who is soul incarnate and turns them into body and soul. So there's not supposed to be a separation there. So that, anyway, that was one big takeaway that I ran into in this, that we treat our physical life and our spiritual life as though those are two different things, when we should be united as a person and know that the things that we do with our body, that those are actions of the soul, and vice versa as well. So,
with your experience as an actor, or your life as an actor and then author, and doing these things, it's interesting because when I've been thinking about that area in particular, and this is coming out in what you're talking about, but that's an area that, unlike so many things, just requires enduring, you know, putting aside, most of the time it involves putting aside immediate gratification to a certain extent, to be able to, I mean, this is with musical instruments, with acting, whatever, because you don't just like start it and then it's like, oh, now I'm there. I'm done. I've got what I need. It's, I mean, there might be a joy in doing some of those things, but it's usually a struggle to get to some place, but there's the perseverance in it. And so when you're talking about fitness, when you're talking about these actions, the virtue, basically building towards these things, it's just really interesting to me because it seems like it's so different than kind of our popular idea of those areas of acting or being a musician or being in front of people, that it's like, oh, it's all instant gratification. But right. I think it's exactly the opposite. It's being able to put off those things for so, I mean, for most people, it's putting right. off those immediate goods for a greater good down the road, you know, those things. But
yeah, absolutely. I think you're right that it is that it affects kind of that idea of being able to delay gratification or put in a lot of work that we don't necessarily sensibly see the payoff of. That's central to not only fitness, it's central to if you want to have a career in a difficult field. It's central to raising a family. It's central to living out life on Earth in this, you know, in this valley of tears that the world is. All of it requires persevering to the end, and that for a lot of those, our obligation, our call to difficult work and to suffer out of love in every aspect of our life, that the end point of that is entry into the kingdom of heaven. And so we are not relieved of our duty until we die. And there's, you know, it can be like, oh man, that's asking a lot. Or it can be this kind of beautiful call of going, this is the call. This is the job. And the job is offer all the sufferings that life presents you in at the service of good, at the service of love, and at the service of God. And offer all that back to him, and it will be worth it. And praise God, we get glimpses of that and in this life, you know. But as Chesterton's great character Father Brown says, we're on the wrong side of the tapestry. So we get hints of beauty and of grace, and that we're contributing to something meaningful, but that we don't see the full picture of it. You know, we're on the wrong side of the tapestry. We see the loops of thread, and we don't see the great picture that God is drawing with our life and the lives of all those that we come in contact with and love. But again, we get these glimpses of that. And, you know, I mentioned in this experience that I had in my other book, How to Be Miserable and Alone. I mentioned it in other stuff too, but this idea that I remember having this experience once when I was going through a particularly difficult time of suffering, of experiencing a lot of kind of rejection across the board, both in my personal life and professional life, and feeling like it was happening in my spiritual life too. And then I had this, you know, I roll my eyes anytime anyone says the word vision, but you know, it. Call it a vision or a daydream or a whatever, but just this sense of seeing more than I had seen before, and this just was presented with this image of myself as an old man, and standing with someone who I presumed is, you know, was my wife, who was an old woman, and generations of my family in front of me, my children and their children and their children's children. And above all of it, the roof over our heads was opened up, and the whole Milky Way galaxy was and more than that, it was like a tear in the roof was tearing open the universe, and just seeing this power of the creative love of God pouring down in to myself and my family, and that this idea that suddenly this difference of understanding of going, this is what I have planned for you. And it might not look exactly, you know, like this is an image of that. This is an icon of that. But that what I have planned for you is a life of creativity, whether that's and a creative life-giving love. And so that this God of the universe is speaking to me at the time, and to anyone else who will hear, saying, you know, this God who made the stars, made the sun, and the moon and the earth, and you know, wildebeest migrating across Africa, and he looks at us after creating all of this and goes, okay, your turn. Okay, you try. And that's the purpose of our lives, is to live this life-giving love. And for all of us, that is a call to holiness. For all of us, that is a call to leave the world with more life than we were given, with more love than we knew that we had, to make it a more loving place by having lived in it. That's our call to holiness, and it may also come out in different ways for people who are called to married life, to bring children into the world, for priests or religious, to create and to give in those ways. And, you know, for artists, it may also mean that that there's a creative love that causes them to create things of beauty that remind people of the love of God and show that to them. But that all of us are given that task of, this is what I have created out of love. Now you try.
Important to keep that in mind. Is a number of things that you've talked about just reminds me of those trips to confession, where at one point a priest was saying, you know, what is it that God is already providing to you and wants to offer you? What is it that he's offering you that you're rejecting in order to find a more immediate pleasure or good in this? Because you always choose the good, even though some of the things we choose are ultimately evil. But what is it that you're desiring? God's offering that to you, but why are you choosing this instead of what he's offering you? And so that longevity that you're talking about there, about just keeping that idea that God's was calling you, or calling all of us, to create, to participate with him in this, to walk with him in that. And so often it's just like, no, I'm going to go do this little self-destructive thing over here instead, yeah, because it's immediately
hard. Gratified. That's hard.
But, yeah. Yeah. Choosing consumption over creation, choosing gratification over truth in and of themselves. You know, gratification is not necessarily a bad thing. Consumption is you know, consuming things or not, you know, if anyone who's involved in for instance education or in entertainment or in any of those things, if we don't have people consuming education, consuming entertainment, well, the creation of it doesn't matter. So it's not to denigrate those things as aspects of it, but when we make that our modus operandi, when that is how we approach the world, is consumption at the expense of creation, and you know, pleasure at the expense of truth, and jadedness at the expense of beauty and that kind of thing, like I mean, I guess jadedness is always that way, but I think that really it's very easy to get into that mode, and it's not a good mode to be in. The other way is a good mode.
Kind of slippery slope too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Chesterton says a man might conceivably achieve a steady level of good, but not of evil. Evil is a road that goes ever downward.
So true. All right. So drawing upon your experience in and lessons you've learned, drawn from a lot of effort you've put in and life you've lived, and to come to some lessons in flexibility and grit and virtue building, I will present you with a hypothetical situation
of
homeschooling families addressing some whatever work they have before them, students, parents. I mean, there are parallel tracks for both the parents and the students in approaching their kind of daily doings. There's some resistance to doing that. Why do we have to do this? I don't want to do this. Things like that. What words might you offer to drawing upon your work and experience to help us kind of look right at that and overcome it?
So I will answer that with what I told myself this morning.
Okay.
So, oh man, because this is, you know, it's this is not it is not something that like that goes away. The idea of being reluctant to do the best good for ourselves. I say in Grit and Glory, I don't know that I've ever enjoyed a workout, but I always enjoy having done a workout. I've done a lot of obstacle races, and you know, if you ask me, I will say, "Oh my gosh, they're so much fun." I don't know that they are. They're really fun when you cross the finish line and you go, "Oh my gosh, that was awesome! I can't believe," you know. But they're not fun while you're doing them. You know what? There are exceptions to that. Sometimes you can get into a great rhythm when it's just the trail run part of it, and boy, sometimes it actually does feel good. But in general, I mean, this is this, you know, period of discipline and suffering that you're going through. And then you go to the end of it and you go, "Oh my gosh, that was awesome." And that's something that my wife and I were just talking about this morning, and that I was talking to myself about, is this idea of, take a vow outside of being in the moment and go, "This is what I'm going to do." And then just start on that decision. Just take action towards that decision. So like tonight we were talking about, okay, we are really wanting to do some writing. She and I write together now, and we have not written together in a long time. And also we have four baskets full of laundry that have not been folded and are stacking up in the corner of the house. So we said, okay, here is the vow for tonight. The vow is, me, Kaiser, I will fold laundry and be what we call the pacer. And while you will sit and type, you'll be the writer, I'll be the pacer. Because whenever people are writing together, there's the pacer and the writer. There's the person who's putting it down and contributing their own ideas, and the other person who's just going, "Okay, well, this is what we need to do," and that kind of thing. And we said, "Okay, we're going to do an hour of that." And, you know, come heck or high water, I can promise you at 8 p.m. tonight, no matter what else I have figured that I want to do instead at that point, which will probably be like, "I just want to sit on the couch and watch a show," because, you know, the kids are still not asleep. They should be, but they're not. But instead, what I will do is I will just pick up one towel and I will fold it. And I will put the computer in front of my wife and I will say, "Open up a document and start typing words. It doesn't matter what the words are, just start typing them." And just take action into the thing that you're supposed to do. Whether it's meaningful action or not, as long as you take action towards it, you show yourself that you are keeping your promises and that you are keeping the vows and doing the work that's set before you. As you do that, it becomes easier to continue to do that. even just in the moment, it becomes easier to do that. I remember listening to, I think, one of Father Mike's homilies and stuff, and he was talking about some study where they said, like, if you could, the people could form a habit of fitness if all they did was put on their shoes and step outside the door. And they didn't, you know, for the first week, they didn't have to take one step past outside the front door. All they had to do was put on their shoes, step outside the front door. And then what they found out was this, you know, huge percentage of them, like, well, I've already got my shoes on and I'm already outside the front door. I might as well walk down to the end of the driveway and back, you know, and stuff. And then pretty soon you're running around the block, and pretty soon you're running miles, because you literally took that first step. And if you take action before you have the opportunity to second guess that, you just go, this is what I said I was going to do. I'm going to do it. Even if it's just this, even if I just start, if I do nothing else, if I do nothing productive, if I do nothing meaningful in this time, I at least did the first thing that I said I was going to do. And I think that comes down to, acting coach of mine said, action precedes motivation. That you discover your motivation after you've already started to take action. And I think it comes down to, like, what, you know, St. Paul talks about this idea, you know, he's already in his, you know, 70s or something at this point, when he says, you know, I bludgeon and subdue my body for the sake of the kingdom, you know, stuff like that, just so that he's like, I've got to, every day I'm still having to go, all right, let's get at it. Let's, you know, whip myself into shape here, so that I make the right choices instead of just sliding into what's easy. And I guess that's something that I think I'd like to incorporate more with, like, my kids, of going, okay, yes, we look at this room and we go, it is a mess. Or we look at, you've got 20 problems to do in your, you know, math book. Let's just do this one, or let's just put away this one thing. And I'll be there with you, and you do that, and then we'll see how we're doing, and we'll go again. You know, was it Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird? I think, I've never read the book, but just that story. There's a story that I know that I have heard recounted to me secondhand of this kid. You know, her brother had left this whole project till the day before it was due. It was supposed to have, you know, 48. Profiles of birds and stuff, and the dad just goes, okay, bud, bird by bird, let's start with one and we'll go from there. And just that, if we take action, we will discover, we will find motivation, and pretty soon you know, we're doing things that we wouldn't have thought possible, just because we did one small thing that kept a promise to ourselves.
Like the scope of what you're doing there, because I you know, I have this problem myself, but I think it's fairly common that you set that initial goal too large. And then, yeah, as you say, just like in your example, you are the sort of person who puts on their shoes and steps outside, yeah, in the morning. It does this. If you set those goals too big, you're the sort of person who fails at whatever they seek to do, which is right. Bad. I mean, so you're destroying yourself by setting the goals too big. It's like, no, just take that first step. Take that, yeah, first thing. Don't worry about, you know, I want to run a marathon. Start by walking to the end of your driveway or stepping outside.
Yeah. Yeah. In Imitation of Christ, Thomas A. Kempis talks about, you know, he says, he relates a story of, there was this guy who was filled with much anxiety, and he prays before God. He goes, I'm filled with all these anxieties and concerns, and, like, I don't know what your will is and stuff like that. And God responds and says, if you did know my will, what would you do? And the guy goes, oh, okay, I'll go do that. It's like, just that, if you just, again, yeah, take those small actions, it reduces your anxiety. It changes your vision of who you are as a person. Like you said, I'm the person who puts on my shoes and steps outside. And maybe I'm the person who takes a couple of steps down the driveway tomorrow, and then the next day, well, I guess I've discovered I'm the person who goes for a run around the block, and then pretty soon you go, oh my gosh, I'm the person who just ran a marathon, and rather than going, oh man, how am I supposed to run 26.2 miles? I can't do that. Never mind, forget it. Yeah. It's too hard. Instead of being that person, you're the person who did one small thing and just kept doing small things until they, you know, little things with great love, as Thérèse of Lisieux might say.
This has been a fabulous time together. As we're coming to the end of this time together, do you have any advice you would leave for aspiring writers or actors, particularly for whom their faith is central to them and would like it to remain so, but would like to enter into perhaps the entertainment industry or any industry, really? any words of wisdom there in that regard?
I guess I would say in general, if you are someone who aspires to have art as a career, and I think that acting is an art and writing is an art, and writing in particular is writing is the only part of the entertainment industry where one creates out of nothing, and the rest of it, this is, I'm totally stealing the part of this book called Kill the Dog that I just started reading, but that everything else is an interpretation of the creation of the writer, but all of it is creation, and all of it is like, there is creation in interpretation, and there's elevation in interpretation, and for all of it, do the creative thing at least a little bit every day. I think so many of us look at the creative fields and go, well, you've got it or you don't. And if you got it, you don't have to work at it. And you just got to get the business part of it figured out and stuff. You just got to get somebody to pay you for it. And then you're a professional. But that's not your call as a Catholic. Your call as a Catholic is to be great, to demonstrate and live out and transmit truth, beauty, and goodness in everything you do. And you do that first by being really good at your craft, because that's the only way that people will be able to be influenced by the truth, the beauty, and the goodness of what you're doing. Like, if your call is to creation and your call is to do something creative, then you've got to do it. Do some part of it every day. Be really, really, really good. Make things that are good and true and beautiful, and the rest of it, you'll figure it out. like, if you have stuff and you share stuff with people that is true and good and beautiful, that will find a home. Do the work that God has put on your heart, and he will find a way for people to hear it. Just do it and keep doing it. And if you find that you really go, you know what? Even in the having done it, I don't actually experience joy in this. Like I said, it's one thing to go, I don't experience joy in the doing of it. So you may not experience joy in the doing of it, but if you don't experience joy in the having done it, then maybe it's not your call. There's this kind of persistent advice of given to actors. Is if you can do anything else, if you can do anything else, do that. Because this requires an intensity of work and effort and suffering that you may not ever see the fruits of. But again, that's kind of the call of life, is that it requires an intensity of work and effort and suffering that you might not see the fruits that you want or the fruits that you expect out of it. But I think there's a jaded way to say, if you can do anything else, do that. But I don't mean it in a jaded way. I just mean, if you can do anything else, that's probably what you should be doing, is doing that other thing. Because if you don't experience this great joy at having done it, regardless of the results of it, it's probably not for you. So I for most of my life I've had this I've hated auditioning. And I had this shift a few years ago of this, like, the audition may be the only part of the job I get to do. For most of the time, you hear about actors who famously have had hundreds of auditions in between booking a job. For on-camera jobs, if you audition between 20 and 50 times and you get one job out of that, that's a pretty good batting average. For voiceover, if you audition 1 to 200 times and you get one job out of that, that's a pretty good batting average. And so just this realization of this audition is an opportunity for me to act. Like this is the job. This is the job. And this is what I get to do is breathe life into a character and take them from the page to reality. And how dare I treat that lightly? How dare I resent that? This is an opportunity to create something and make it real. And if this is all I do with it, I have done my job for the day, and I've done my work for the day. And so now it's totally changed the way that I approach auditions, and my auditions have vastly improved because of it. And my, the ratio at which I get called back and book things has greatly improved because of it. But that's not the reason I did it. The reason that those have improved is because I started treating the thing as the thing. That I go, that is the job. We're not practicing for some other job. Like that's the job is auditioning. And again, it's one of those things that translates into life too. Like, there's that thing of if you pray for patience, God will give you opportunities to be patient. And this sense of like this is not practice for something else. This is the life that we have, and be in it and do it and make something good and true and beautiful, and God will do the rest.
Fantastic. Kaiser, what a real gift it has been to get to visit with you today. Thank you so much for all that you have done to help us along our own paths toward holiness and build growing in virtue and grit and everything. And we really appreciate it. Know of our prayers for you and your family. And thanks so much for coming to visit with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure. And we'll take all the prayers we can get. So thank you.
Subscribe to the ColbyCast on your favorite podcast app so that you don't miss an episode. And let us know how we're doing by leaving a rating or a review. And as always, feel free to email us at podcast@colby.org.
Mary, our Mother, pray for us. St. Maximilian Kolbe, St. Ignatius of Loyola, Holy Saints and Angels, pray for us. Ad Maiorem Dei Gloriam.